Prepare to Pivot is a series of conversations with Dr. Andrew Barnes, Dean of the School of the Arts, Communications, and Global Studies at York College of Pennsylvania. Dean Barnes talks with leaders in the college, YCP alums, and members of the York community about the importance of the liberal arts in preparing students to build careers where essential skills like critical and creative thinking, effective communications, and analytical reasoning make all the difference. And now, here's Dean Barnes.
Hi, welcome to Prepare to Pivot, the podcast that talks about the liberal arts and how they prepare students to pivot in their careers and in their lives. Today, I'm really excited because I have one of our alums here, Jeff Brown, who is a history major from 1995. You graduated and is working as an engineer. So you are the perfect example for me for what I've been talking about, the way in which liberal arts prepares you for a career. So welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
I wanted to start just a little bit about, just tell me your story. You came here. Why did you come here to York College?
I came to York College. Well, I started out in architecture.
Oh, you did?
Architecture.
Oh, I'm glad you got out of it. That's a tough degree.
Brutal field.
It's brutal.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
So I started in architecture and lasted a year. But during
You survived a year.
I survived a year.
Yeah.
But during architecture, took classes that were, they teach about the history of architecture. So they teach about the history. They teach a history of art. History of art.
Yeah.
History of art. So I didn't care about the designs.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't care about the seminars and the professors yelling at me about my designs and having to defend my work every afternoon and staying up to 3 o'clock in the morning to prepare film core exhibits and designs.
Yeah.
What really grabbed me was when I was sitting in seminar halls, listening and watching the professor discuss the history of art and the evolution of civilization around art, which was the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah, right.
You can track the progress of civilization by their art.
Sure.
The development of art.
Yeah.
The rise and fall.
Yep.
Gothic architecture, Renaissance architecture, modern architecture.
Which tracks with art, which tracks with writing, which tracks with a lot of different forms.
Like, it really grabbed me. I said, wow, this is something that triggered something in me. And I'm like, I always liked history. I liked history. And my best course in high school is history.
That was an indication.
So, as a freshman, you make the connection. Hey, I liked history in high school. I like this. I'm passionate about this. I like this. I look forward to this class.
Yeah.
It was a 6 to 9 class at night, which is never fun.
That's
but
right.
I look forward to going to it. So I pivoted out of that and left architecture and decided I was going to pursue history at York, but at the same time, I decided, well, I need a skill. I need a marketable skill.
yeah, sure.
And decided to concentrate on drafting, engineering drafting, architectural drafting.
Yeah.
So I went to Catonsville Community College at the same time that I was going. So I was coming here to Catonsville Community College, which is now BCC, which I think is Baltimore County Community College.
Yeah, yeah.
Or as they call it, University of Catonsville, left of Arbutus, UCLA, back in the day. So I went to Catonsville and came to York College pretty much at the same time, the same time period. So I was getting an associate's and a bachelor's
at the same
time.
In history, yeah.
Now, what reinforced me at Catonsville was my first course. They had a civilization course with Dr. Marks. And that was like, you're studying Arnold Toynbee, which is, why are you studying Arnold Toynbee, a historian, as a freshman in community college? Marie Curie, Darwin, they had this one condensed course. Yeah, one condensed course about civilization. So her passion, she had such passion for the work and her insights.
Yep.
She almost had a superpower. It was like a superpower. It's like, I want that power.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah.
So that kind of reinforced me coming to York. So I came to York. I decided after taking that course when I was at Catonsville that this is what I'm going to do. I want to major in history. So I went there for a semester and decided, I'll finish up there, get my associates, and then I'll come to York for history.
For history.
So it was, relatively close. They had a good program. They had great professors.
Still do.
Yeah, they still do. And decided that I would do the 4-year program here and finish history. Now, the question always was, well, everybody who asked me,
right,
even back then,
what are you going to do with this?
So you're like, well, I got this associate's degree in design, and that got me into the workforce doing entry-level drafting and design.
Right,
you know, T-squares, right. CAD, computer-aided right. drafting, stuff like that. Not very glamorous.
Grunt work. Yeah, but I mean, it gave you those kinds of skills. You hit on something. I just want to stop you just a moment. You hit on two really important things. Actually, you used a word twice called passion.
Yes.
The word passion.
Yeah.
You said you had a passion for history. So we went to classes. You were excited to go
excited.
To classes.
Yeah.
And you had that. And you had a teacher who had a passion.
Passion.
That sort of ignited that.
Yeah.
Those two are key for any kind of good education, especially in the liberal arts. And we tried to tell students and their parents who want them to be pre-professionals, which is fine. Listen to your student, your kids. What are they passionate about?
Yes.
What are they going to get out of bed for? What are they going to go to a 6 o'clock class at night for? What's that? And key into that, because then you're halfway, the battle's halfway over.
Yeah, definitely. Right? Definitely. Wow. I still remember Dr. Marks and her sitting there in that class in Catonsville.
Yeah.
You know, and listening and watching her demeanor and being just completely
amazing.
Of the way she grasped data, the way she grasped information, the way she was preparing information and reading the information and just that, you know, you could definitely just lay out your future at that point.
That's right, yeah. So you had this degree in history. You had this drafting skills.
Yeah.
And that's where you started. You started in drafting.
Started in drafting.
And how did you progress up to where you are?
I did something very unique at the time, which was this is the mid-90s. I had a computer, and I had CompuServe.
In the mid-90s,
America Online was big. Everybody remembers this. You go to the grocery store, they're handing the stuff out. So I decided what I'll do is, you know, I'll go to – it was a website called JobTrack, which is like the pre-Monster, pre-Indeed.
Oh, really?
I typed in history, jobs.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Guess how many? What it came up?
One. Teaching. One. No.
No, really?
One job came up.
What was it?
Dr. Micarelli at the Census Bureau.
Ah.
Was hiring a historian.
Yeah. For the census. That makes kind of sense,
Didn't get the job.
Well, that's okay.
But he referred me, the Census Bureau for the decennial census, Census 2000, they're hiring analysts.
Oh, yeah.
And because I was at York College, I got my degree, and I also had a great – I think they had an outstanding scholar program. So if you had something like a greater than a 3.5 GPA, they would hire you direct. You didn't have to go through the whole hiring
program,
the whole – Office Personnel Management hiring process, which would take 3 years or whatever the time frame
was. Right.
So they would just hire you direct. So that was the entry level in.
And you got that because you could, from your history, you could analyze.
I could analyze.
You knew how to analyze data because you knew how to analyze text. You knew how to read text. You knew how to do that kind of research.
Reading, writing, research, analytics, being able to present data, being able to take assignments and figure out, you know, reading.
Yeah.
We would read the Code of Federal Regulations, and then you would determine how that code was impactful to operations.
This is interesting because most people, when they think about the humanities or liberal arts, they think about we're sitting around reading Byron and romantic poetry or studying the Civil War, which is great. And we are doing those things. But in the process, we're learning how to analyze, how to read critically. And these translate directly into the kind of skills you're talking about. We could read, you know, data. We could look at a set of data and look for not only what the data shows us, but what's behind it.
You're looking for the acorns.
That's right.
You're looking for
that's
acorns.
A good point, yeah.
You're looking for the acorns. You walk through a forest, how many times do you pass over the acorns?
That's right.
The analysts, the liberal arts guys, they look for the acorns.
Never heard that before, looking for the acorns.
They look for the acorns. And they plant the acorns and they become trees. Or we take nothing. I mean, I tell people we get magic pixie dust and we figure out how to sprinkle a couple of ideas and develop ideas and concepts and then sell those ideas.
And that happens, I'm sure it happens to you all the time, but we're constantly asked to, you know, think of an idea and articulate that idea.
Yes.
And articulate it in a way that someone above you or someone else who's not in the field necessarily or doesn't know your expertise can understand it.
Yes.
And I'm asked that all the time, is not to get too far in the weeds, but can you take this information, present it in a way that a general audience can understand it? You may have it different because you're in an engineering field, so you probably get in the weeds all the time, but it gives us that skill to do both, to do very large and to do very sort of concentrated.
You break out very complex problems and make it very simple for people to understand in bullets, right?
In bullet points
so people can understand it and it becomes actionable and it becomes repeatable and scalable.
Well, and this is the one thing I'd learned as an English person. I know you're a historian. We're in English.
Yeah.
Right now, we're terrible. Is that idea of reducing down, because, you know, English people, we like to expand. We like to sort of give the narrative and expand. And really to reduce that down into bullet points that kind of convey what we want to say in sort of digestible.
Yeah, historians like the story. Tell the story.
Yeah, historians like the same thing. So yeah, and how did you get into engineering? Your sort of current position.
Yeah, it was a bit of a journey. I mean, you know, coming into the Census Bureau as you know, working with a lot. Census Bureau is a lot of mathematicians. Well,
yeah,
I bet. There are a lot of statisticians. They're very passionate people. Statistics,
yeah.
Mathematicians, you know, the place is teeming with scientists.
Yeah.
And, so I jumped there. I went to the Department of Defense, worked with a lot of IT folks.
So you've worked with a lot of STEM people.
Yeah, a lot of STEM folks. I went from mathematicians, statisticians, went to the Department of Defense and worked with a lot of engineers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Logistics.
Oh, my gosh. You've worked with all the STEM.
Yeah. IT and then hit IT while I was there.
Uh-huh.
So I was always on the outside looking at him. I mean,
yeah. How did they kind of respond to you as this?
The history guy.
The history guy. That's how they would say to you, history guy.
Oh, you got a degree in history?
Really?
You got a degree in history? What? What are you doing?
What are you doing here? Why aren't you reading a book in history?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or why aren't you teaching?
I was always the novelty. I was always on the outside.
Well, was there a point when in your careers when they realized what the skill is that you brought and went,
Well, it's what becomes marketable. When I started getting into thinking, how am I going to market myself? How am I going to survive in this career? And,
yeah.
And I really started looking at project management.
Uh-huh.
Is if you look at what project management is, it's project management, and I have my PMP, my project management professional project management. What's PMP stand for? Project management professional. That's what it stands for. PMP.
One of those.
Yeah, acronyms. From the PMI. So that is, you know, that turns into how do you manage projects? And a project manager manages projects through people. Project manager doesn't do the project. They don't do anything associated with the project.
That's right.
They manage the people doing the work. You're hiring the engineers.
Yep.
You're hiring the scientists.
That's right.
You're hiring the IT folks to do the work for you. They're doing the math.
Mm-hmm.
I'm paying the bills. They're doing the math. So, you know, you define a scope. You define a budget.
Yep.
You define a schedule. I'm answerable to, you know, a leadership who's paying for that scope. So you're doing a lot of... I mean, basically, you're a project manager. You're leading the team. You're leading the group to execute to build a product, which is defined by that scope and budget.
Mm-hmm.
So that comes down to how do you do that? What do you do? How do you take those ideas and how do you communicate that out to the team?
Well, this is why I think that we see in business. The leaders in business and schools and higher education often come from the liberal arts because we have these sort of people skills. We have these skills to manage people, to manage projects, unlike some of the other areas that are more narrowly focused, like computer science, engineering. Although I have to say our new president is a chemist, so that maybe is an exception. He's a super nice guy, which he'll be on, I think, soon on this podcast. It's just interesting to me that you, this historian, among all these STEM people, I tell this story a lot when I do open houses, that I've talked to some business people, and they gave me an example once of this guy, this young guy who came out of engineering school, really great engineer, and he was doing great, but he could not really speak or could not write. And they were kind of saying, you know, this guy's not going anywhere. Because he cannot write, he will always be doing this kind of entry level.
Yeah.
Do you see that in?
I do.
A lot coming out.
I do. Engineers are very. Sometimes they stay very much in their own box.
Yeah, they're introverts too.
Yeah, they're introverts. Yeah. They stay in their box. They like the numbers. They like to control the numbers.
A lot of safety there. A lot of comfort.
A lot of comfort. They like it's black and white for them.
Yep.
They need the answer. They need that definitive answer.
Yep.
Which comes in that comfort that comes from them doing the analysis and presenting it. Liberal arts people live in the world of the unknown. I live in the world of the gray. The white space is between the items that need to happen.
Yep.
And trying to get ahead of it and seeing where those spaces are and those gaps are and figuring out the risks associated with those gaps to make sure that they're working together correctly.
Yeah, and that's really what you're defining as kind of a creative strategy, that we have that ability to think creatively and think outside the box.
Questioning the status quo, being able to identify items that need to occur that may impact that status quo and kind of pushing it forward and motivating people and understanding, like looking at that introvert engineer and trying to figure out how you can draw him out into the team
that's right.
and working with that person because they do have value.
Of course they do. Yeah, they have all those skills. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's utilizing that and figuring out how they can contribute.
Yeah. I like this idea that the gray space is kind of the creative space. The gray space is the innovative space.
Yeah, it is.
Because that's from that kind of gray, that kind of fog, as it were, you can sort of bring something out. You can create something.
I brought that up to an engineer. I said, I live in it's like fog of war. And they didn't know what that meant. They're like, what does fog of war mean? Like, that's where we live, in the fog of war, where you just don't know what the decision is, but you have to drive with the uncertainty to get to a point.
Yeah.
And then you can move on.
It's also really a great life skill, right? Because we like to think that life is very sort of black and white. It's very kind of, this is the road I'm going down. I wanted to go down this road, but life doesn't happen that way.
No, it doesn't.
It's always throwing things at you. And I think we're just better kind of sort of situated to kind of deal with that chaos.
Adaptability and flexibility is what you need to be successful in the business place. You can't sit on one idea and expect it to be successful all the time.
That's right. That's right.
The minute you buy into that idea, it becomes stale. A minute later, it is stale.
This is interesting because I would think that engineering and technology is a constantly changing field with innovations that are coming. And how do engineers, how do they adapt to that? Do they have a difficult time adapting to sort of those innovations that come through the field? Or does it take a person like you to say, hey,
move. They're very process oriented. So generally, it's a leadership issue that comes down, and they'll move when the organization tells them to move.
Is that right?
Yes.
And so they'll be sort of obey that command, as it were.
Yeah.
Wow, that's super interesting. You know, here at York, I tried to tell students who are in STEM that they get these skills in the general education that we have. So that when they take a writing class, when they take a literature or a history class, that this is where they start getting these critical creative skills, these communication skills that they'll need in business. Often what we run into is that they want to just stay in their major. I just want to get my engineering degree, get out and get a job.
See, I think it should be thought differently. I hear the word STEM and I cringe.
Yeah.
I think there needs to be an A added in the STEM and call it STEAM.
Yep, indeed.
And it should be advertised that not everybody is a STEM person.
Right.
And there should be an off-ramp to go into the A, which is the arts.
That's right.
And I get irritated when I hear that STEM is the only path to success. And
it gets
marketed, and the propaganda's out there where that's the only thing that you can do to be successful in the business place. And people get bought into that, and they get 2 or 3 years into it, or they get in the market. I work with many engineers who go, if I had to do this again, I would not be an engineer.
Is that right?
I do not like what I do.
Wow. I think that's true for a lot of people that are in these pre-professionals. Again, great you're in a pre-professional, but they really get into this mindset, and they're not allowing themselves to see the possibilities.
They get stuck into the rut of this is what they need to go do, and they're afraid to take a step out because it feels unnatural to them.
It feels unnatural to them.
And what are they going to do when they're 30, 35, or 40, and then they're miserable?
Well, this is what I'm trying to sort of spread this word of the liberal arts, because those people who are 30, 35 realize they're in a horrible career. If they had sort of a strong liberal arts background, they could pivot.
Yeah.
They could pivot into something else.
You can do so many different things. You can be an analyst. You can be you can go in accounting. You can be a lawyer. You can be a project manager. I mean, many project managers I work with.
Well, it's interesting these days what we get in the liberal arts. A lot of people like you that did way back when you started in architecture, and it was the history that informed you, that brought you over to the liberal arts. So we get a lot of found majors.
Yeah.
They come here because whatever, their parents, society, their group of friends say, no, you have to be an engineer, you have to be a nursing student, you have to be education. And they get here and they start taking classes in literature and history, and they go, hey, I kind of like this.
Yeah.
And it all goes back again when I talk to parents, what is your student passion or your child passionate about? Find that passion. And then if they get a degree in history, they'll get a job.
They will.
They'll have a career out there.
Yeah.
But it's more important to have sort of that sort of passion. So I guess I'm going to ask you this question of what advice you give to students that are coming into freshman year in the year 2023.
2023. Wow.
If you can imagine
Oh, boy, the advice I would give. Put your phone down.
Put your phone down.
A little bit.
Yeah.
This is what I tell I work with a lot of folks that are either in the field I'm in right now. I work with a lot of 20, 21, 22 years old that are either coming at technical school or going to college. I got one person actually who goes to York College that works for me in engineering, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So I tell them what I just said. Just find what you like to do. Don't chase the dollars.
Yeah.
Chase what you like to do.
Dollars will come later.
The dollars will come later. Yeah. Don't worry about the money.
Yeah.
Do what you want to do. Chase your passion.
Yeah.
Don't force it. Yep. Because you're just going to end up putting yourself in a box and making yourself miserable in the long run.
And that's what we get. We get a lot of people who come out, you know, graduate with these pre-professionals, and they find out they don't like that. Like you said, they're miserable.
They're miserable.
And it's hard for them to change. I also think, though, that as liberal arts people, as humanities people, we have to recognize the changing landscape. And so here at York, we're doing a couple of things. I'm putting together a degree called Applied Humanities, which takes the humanities and applies it to kind of real world problems to show people that this is not just a navel gazing degree, that it has an application to it. But I'm also putting together, I hope, a humanities task force that can sort of look around the nation and say, what should we be now? And how do we advocate for STEAM, like you were talking about? How do we do it on a national level, saying, no, the humanities, liberal arts, these arts are important and we need to get back to them? We really kind of threw them overboard when STEM came. Right.
Yeah,
when that STEM came, we just said, forget the arts. And what we're realizing now, too late, is, that art piece is, whether it's art, fine arts, or liberal arts, it's really important.
It's the idea. The STEAM doesn't exist without that idea of somebody coming up with that idea, which comes from the humanities side.
It almost always does. It almost always does.
So that's why the idea, if you don't have good ideas, you're not going to have scientists, or you're not going to have...
That's right.
You're not going to have engineers building things.
That's right.
Because there's no ideas for them to build upon.
And I think people were starting to get that pendulum's starting to swing back. So it's looking at the liberal arts and the arts and saying, this is a really important component.
I hope so, because I just read an article in the paper that West Virginia is doing away with
it. I know. Well, this is my big concern, too, is that, you know, some of the, especially the publics, are in really danger right now. And so the easy thing to do, get rid of the languages, get rid of the liberal arts. That's the easy thing to do. What that's going to create is this two-tiered education system here in America, that if you're elite, if you can afford to go to the Ivies, or if you want to go one of the big research ones, those are the only ones that are going to teach liberal arts.
Yeah.
If you're a regional person and you want to do liberal arts, there's no place to go. But as long as I'm dean here, we're going to – I mean, I'm serious. We're really putting our sort of efforts to be a regional college that still believes in liberal arts and allows people like you to come here and get a history degree. Or people, even if they're getting an engineering degree, to still take a really robust liberal arts program, but not to abandon that. I think the publics that are doing it are very short-sighted. They have a lot of financial pressures on it, I know, but it's very short-sighted.
Yeah, definitely.
But I think it's for colleges like York, it's our opportunity to kind of step into that little void and say, hey, we'll take them. We're here. We're still here. So it's awesome. Any other sort of last words of advice for how about for parents who have to whose kids are going off to school? I want to be an artist, and they're going, you must be an engineer.
Any last advice to kids? Wow, to parents.
Parents.
I'm a parent. Well, I have a kid that's starting college.
And so what are they majoring in?
IT.
IT.
But that's the way his brain operates.
But if that's good. I mean, that's
what his passion is. He loves IT.
That's right.
So
just tell him not to forget the liberal arts.
Yeah, he'll be fine in that regard.
That's good.
Don't be afraid of the liberal arts.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at right now what's going on in society. You know, without strong, robust liberal arts, of people being able to understand and be able to dissect
and contextualize
and come up with their own ideas on how things are occurring and what's going on today. It's a superpower. I consider it a superpower.
It is.
Liberal arts is a superpower, and it'll never expire.
That's right.
It's a skill that you can continuously sharpen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a skill that can get you very far in the workplace because it's a skill that large companies or any company, they want people coming in that can do, they can read, they can write, they can communicate, they can analyze, they can take information, they can take data, not information, they can take data and turn that data into information.
Yeah.
And they could take that information and act upon that information.
Well, my big takeaway from this is that the liberal arts is a superpower.
It's a superpower.
That's the new tagline. The liberal arts is a superpower.
It's a superpower. Use it.
Awesome.
It's fun.
It is fun, isn't it?
I joke around with engineers all the time. And I say, you are the type of person I would walk by the lab at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when I got back from the bar, and I'd see you in there slaving away, trying to figure out how to solve some problem, while I, the historian, had my papers done.
Yeah.
I can read, write, research. I could figure out how to do that quickly because I was able to hone those skills.
Yep.
Like honing a basketball shot or honing the way you drive your car, I was able to hone those skills and understand what I needed to do to get it done and to get it done quickly and to get it done very well.
That's right.
As opposed to you sitting in that. And what did you get out of that?
Yeah. What so liberal arts is a superpower and you can go to the bar more. This is a great idea. Jeff, thank you very much for coming in. You are like my ideal person to be on this podcast because you embody that idea that that the liberal arts allows you to have a really successful career in any field and in engineering in this case.
No, I appreciate you having me.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
This program is produced in the studios of WVYC-FM, the voice of your college, and produced by WVYC radio station manager Jeffrey Schiffman. Join Dean Barnes monthly for these ongoing conversations about essential skills in the liberal arts.